This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Listen to us on KPFK, KPFA, and other Pacifica stations, and watch us on Free Speech TV Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. The ongoing actions at Standing Rock, North Dakota have been met with many gestures of solidarity. One of the most interesting is solidarity from Palestinian rights activists who've seen a clear parallel between the indigenous struggle for sovereignty and treaty rights with the Palestinian struggle for self-determination. One of the leading American academics making such connections for many years is Stephen Salaita, who last year won a settlement with the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign over its rescinding of the offer of a tenured position in the American Indian Studies program. Mr. Salaita is now the Edward W. Said Chair of American Studies at the American University in Beirut, and his earlier book was called Uncivil Rights, Palestine and the Limits of Academic Freedom. He now joins me to discuss his latest book, Internationalism, Decolonizing Native America and Palestine. Welcome to the program, Stephen Salaita.
Thank you for having me.
And I should say internationalism as an inter/nationalism. Can you begin by explaining why the title of your book is not the same as the word internationalism?
Yeah, I put the backslash in between inter and nationalism to kind of highlight the importance of national movements, both in North America and in Palestine, and to sort of try to connect them together. So these are forms of nationalism, or they're national liberation movements, but they're tied into one another, and they have a relationship with one another.
So there's an internationalizing of various nationalist movements, basically.
Exactly, and they're not only in conversation with one another, but they're very often fighting against the same set of forces and the same governments.
So let's first talk about the parallels that there are between the struggles of two geographically very disparate communities. Here in the United States, unfortunately, it's not mainstream anymore to discuss the fact that Native communities were decimated by Western colonialism. It's an ugly part of our history we just don't like to look at, whereas in the Palestinian territories, it is very much the subject of an active conflict that has been going on for many decades and for whom there's no end in sight, where there's, in some cases, actual fighting still happening. So how do you lay the case out for there to be some parallels between these two communities and movements?
First thing that's I think crucial for folks to remember, especially those who are interested in the Palestine side of things, so to speak, is that colonization is ongoing in North America in the territories we now know as Canada and the United States. I think a lot of folks who are sympathetic with Native Americans and with their various movements and with their communities still have a sense of colonization being over or having been finished or existing somehow in the past. But as Standing Rock has been showing a lot of people, the settler colonization is active and it's ongoing in North America. And once we come to that realization and begin to read a little bit more about the processes of U.S. and Canadian settler colonization, it becomes pretty easy to connect it to Palestine. If you take the United States, for example, its politicians as well as Israeli politicians are always going on about a special, unique relationship between the two states. And if we look at the terms and conditions of that special relationship, we see that the language is very often the same. It's a language of national exceptionalism. It's a language of national liberation. And it's a language in which Palestinians and Native Americans themselves have no role except to exist as impediments to a grand march for progress. So one way we can make connections is by looking at the statements of shared values between the U.S. and Israeli governments. But second of all, we're seeing increased efforts among activists and scholars and commentators to keep Native communities and Palestinians, or to put them in conversation with one another. So there are two ways we can make connections. One, in terms of the colonial discourses that exist in North America and in Palestine. And secondly, and in my mind more importantly, between the types of organizing that is being done across national lines, inclusive of Palestinians and Natives.
Now, we may not hear much about this in terms of media coverage, but can you cite instances where groups have actually gone to visit one another? Because, you know, when you actually have a face-to-face meeting, solidarity becomes a lot clearer and the commonality of your struggles become clearer. Have you had Palestinian groups visit Indian reservations, which of course can be very difficult given the restrictions placed on Palestinian movements, and also vice versa, Native and Indigenous groups from the U.S. visiting the Palestinian territories?
Yeah, there have been some examples. In Standing Rock, for instance, there have been individuals and small groups of Palestinians in attendance who have been standing with their brothers and sisters in solidarity and protest. Then there have been people who are known to be aligned with Palestine solidarity politics turn up at Standing Rock. So there's that, but you know, certainly there's always room for more learning, more visitation, better relationships, and it's something that those who are interested in Palestine have opportunities to do. They can do it with respect and with care, and when with the purpose of listening and learning and being respectful of our hosts. And then there have been a number of Indigenous scholars visit Palestine as individually and as part of delegations. So there has been an effort made, and ongoing efforts are being made in the present. I know that there's been a lot of talk, and I certainly hope it comes to fruition, of a delegation of Palestinians visiting Hawaii, which is similarly occupied territory. And there have been groups of Indigenous scholars or scholars in the field of Indigenous studies who have made visits to Palestine and written about their experiences there.
So you are an academic, you're a professor, and let's talk about how in your book you point out that the academic spaces for these discussions can really happen within American Indian Studies departments. Why is that an appropriate place to make those links between Palestinian struggles and Indigenous struggles? I'm guessing there's not too many places where there's a whole program on simply Palestine, although there are Arab Studies programs.
Right. You know, it largely depends on the nature of the institution and the nature of the department or the program. At the University of Illinois, they were in the process of making a move towards Indigenous studies with a global emphasis. And so some programs are developing or already have a particular global emphasis. And I think in those sorts of departments and programs, it's a very interesting place to think about and to explore and to engage the issue of Palestine. And one of the reasons that I think that the connection can be fruitful is that looking at Palestine as a source or a recipient of U.S. policy also helps shine light on some of the domestic imperialistic practices that we see from the United States. And of course, the same is true vice versa. So situating Palestine in a conversation with American Indian Studies or with Indigenous Studies more broadly can be, if it's done carefully, beneficial to both communities.
And in the sort of discourse around Palestine and the disposition of Palestinians, has there been an attempt among Palestinians and even Palestinian academics to see the original Arab inhabitants of the lands as indigenous themselves to that space? Because that can also be an instructive way of examining the current political situation.
The notion of Palestinians as an indigenous community has been in existence in Palestine activism and Palestinian scholarship for many decades. But It's been increasing. Palestinians have been recognized by the United Nations as an indigenous community, so it kind of has a legal imprimatur there. But in terms of the type of theorization that people are doing, it's becoming more and more common because there's been an effort, and again, this has always been in existence in Palestinian thought, but an effort to frame and encourage others to understand what we normally think of as the Israel-Palestine conflict as one of settler colonization, not as a religious conflict or a cultural conflict, but a conflict between a settler colonial entity and an indigenous community. And so once we take up Palestine through the frame of settler colonization rather than one of internecine conflict, then the conceptualization of Palestinians as an indigenous community comes into play.
Let's talk about BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement that you spend a lot of time writing about in your book. This is a very important movement. It's Palestinian-led. It's one that has garnered a lot of controversy here in the United States, where even, you know, some liberal politicians have had their standard Palestine exception. They would support boycotts for, say, the state of North Carolina for its hideous attempt to restrict the bathrooms that transgender folks can use, but then do not approve at all of using similar tactics to point out Israel's occupation and colonization. How important is BDS as a tool to experience what you call internationalism, inter/nationalism?
It's proved useful to that project already, but as I argue in internationalism, it has tremendous untapped potential still. And I see a lot of the folks involved in BDS, Palestinians or otherwise, beginning to tap into that potential. Again, it situates the so-called Israel-Palestine conflict within a framework of settler colonization. And once we do that, we in turn open up spaces to examine the project of ongoing settler colonization in North America. And one thing I argue that BDS activists and scholars ought to take a closer look at in their work, in their activism, is especially those who are located in the West, who are doing this work in the United States or Canada, need to look at the forms of colonization that are happening on the ground on which they stand. And that they not only does it entail a kind of intellectual and theoretical benefit, that it won't only help them understand their own issues better, but it becomes an ethical imperative that if we are going to contest and struggle against settler colonization in Palestine, we also need to understand and contest settler colonization in the spaces in which our work is being conducted. And that's especially true of those who are in the US and Canada. So if BDS continues with this kind of internationalist perspective and begins to pay closer attention to matters of settler colonization in the spaces where BDS work is being conducted, then I think it can be doubly effective, and it certainly will take on a more difficult but a more ethically imperative set of conditions, right? And I think again that's especially true of BDS as it happens outside of Palestine.
Now, we, of course, know that the criticisms of BDS are not necessarily, of course, criticisms of the actual act of boycotting. It is people being upset that Israel is being called out. And of course, the standard equating of criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism that you've been victimized by. And of course, it surprises many of us that this happens at an academic level. We're used to it happening at the activist level. We're used to it happening at the political level. But academia is supposed to be, you know, space free of such biases where, you know, things are judged purely on their merit. You found out that isn't true. How has academia gone backwards, regressed, if you will, on this issue of the Palestinian rights struggle and the boycott, sanctions, divestment movement?
You could probably make a case in either direction, that it's regressed and progressed. It's progressed in the sense that a lot more people are talking about Palestine, and they're doing it with a much more critical vocabulary than might have been normal or acceptable 20 or 30 years ago. So it's been mainstreamed to some degree. A lot of scholarly associations have passed resolutions pledging the boycott. The Modern Language Association, which I think is the largest scholarly organization in the United States, maybe even in the world, is going to be considering a boycott resolution at its next convention this January. So these sorts of things are unprecedented. You know, for people in these kinds of spaces to be talking about Palestine as a site of settler colonization and as a site in need of liberation is happening on a wider scale than it ever has been before. And that's due largely to the intense and courageous work of a lot of faculty and students, you know, people who have put themselves in the crossfire, so to speak, people who've taken tremendous risks in speaking up, people who've shown tremendous courage, because the recrimination that you talk about is very real. And this is where I think we can speak of Palestine as having experienced a bit of a regression. The impetus to punish BDS activists and the impetus to punish those who speak too critically of Israel seems to have increased. The organization Palestine Legal and the Center for Constitutional Rights last year jointly published a report that showed nearly 300 instances of repression on campus directed at those who are doing work around Palestine or doing work critical of Israel. And all of this is happening in the space of less than 2 years. So the types of punishments and the frequency of punishment seem to be on the increase. And we have some empirical evidence that bears that out. But at the same time, if the goal of the recrimination and of the punishment or of the threats is to slow down people's interest in Palestine, it's certainly not working. Because the issue of Palestine is very often center stage on campuses, and I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Right, and as we know, the adage, you know, when you know you're succeeding when you get attacked even harder. Finally, Stephen Salaita, let's talk about another aspect that you discuss in your book, which is how art, poetry, visual art can be a means to find those commonalities between various indigenous struggles against settler colonialism, Palestinian and Native American. You raise the work of several folks such as John Trudell, Russell Means, etc. How rich are those collaborations, those artistic collaborations, and how important are they?
Oh, I think they're hugely important. You know, I was trained formally as a literary scholar, and I've been an avid reader all my life. So I'm always delighted when people manage to look across borders and see a sort of common humanity, and especially a common destiny. And it's one of the beautiful things about reading literature and certainly writing it as well. And so what you're referring to is a chapter in internationalism. And I'd long been interested in how Native poets and Native writers had viewed the issue of Palestine, whether they sensed any sort of affinity for it, whether they cared for it at all. Because in poetry especially, I kept encountering in my readings of Native poets mentions of Palestine. And so I kind of stopped and said, wow. You know, this happens enough to where we can consider it a theme, maybe even a motif, that enough writers are making mention of Palestine or engaging Palestine in a sustained way to where, somebody ought to take a look at it. And it's hugely important for lots of reasons. One, it shows that collaborations don't always have to happen in meeting halls where people are setting up a union or doing a BDS action, that it can happen organically in the way that people think about the world and in turn write about the world, that there's something to these connections that can also exist at a visceral in addition to a theoretical or intellectual level. And one of the interesting things about the Native usages of Palestine as a theme and as a site of interest in their poetry is that they, without fail, the poets look at it as an issue that belongs to Palestinians. And they don't have to filter it through the feelings and the sensibilities of the colonizer or those who are aligned with the colonial society. And so it's a very strong connection that in turn gets made with Palestine and with the Palestinians themselves. And it's very often a beautiful thing. And I'm very much a proponent of the idea that seeking beautiful things in our words and in our art, in our relationships with one another is always a terrific performance of decolonization and of internationalism more broadly.
Well, I agree with you there. Stephen, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck to you with the book.
Thank you so much.
My guest is Stephen Salaita, the Edward W. Said Chair of American Studies at the American University of Beirut, author of Uncivil Rights, Palestine and the Limits of Academic Freedom. We've been speaking about his latest book, Internationalism, Decolonizing Native America and Palestine. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Twitter at twitter.com/RUWithSonali.